This is for the men who never settle. The ones who believe only quitters end a game in a tie. The type of guys who choose the bar with the biggest TVs to overcompensate for theirs at home. This is the Lodge mentality. This is Twin Peaks.
Welcome back to Sports Saturday on Sports Radio 810 WHB. I'm your host, Allie Trost. Tweet me at Allie Trost, A-L-Y-T-R-O-S-T. Blake Schneider is running the board. That is at Wake, the letter N, Blake, 29. That's correct, right?
That is correct.
I was like, I'm like 98% sure it's 29.
Oh, no, you're right. You hit it on the head.
Cool. All right, welcome back. That song really just brings me back to, like, I want to say it was high school.
I don't know.
Maybe grade school?
What are you, 25, 26?
Yeah, 25.
25, yeah. So I think we were in grade school.
Oh, my God. That was like,
did you see my face?
I literally just like lit up when that song came on.
Well, I tried to stylize the music for you today, so.
You always kill it with the music. Well.
I should be a DJ, too.
You should. Hey, I feel like some of this, like, the skills would translate well. I mean, you're running all like the buttons and stuff.
Doing multiple things at once.
Speaking of, tough job right now for, potentially, I know there's been a lot of conversation about whether or not they're going to pump crowd noise into the stadium with Major League Soccer.
Yeah.
Making sure you're pressing the right buttons with the right reaction.
Yeah.
It's
because
a dance.
I mean, the fans are, even though they are predictable, they're kind of unpredictable at the same time. So you never know if they're going to boo a call. So are they going to throw in boos as well? Or are they going to throw in like just the cheers and then the subtle, like just kind of background crowd noise? So.
Yeah, and then, like, goals that look like they're either, like, not going to go in and then do go in. Like,
yeah.
You're like, okay.
It's like, oh.
Like, yeah.
You really got to just be on the volume, just like a DJ. You really do got to be a DJ, up and down with the volume.
Not a job that I myself would want. That would stress me.
I think it'd be fun, but I do that stuff, so it's
right.
Kind of, you know. I got to make sure whenever you're talking to them, I got to turn you down.
Hey, so. But then again, I would do anything to go be a part of a return to play tournament style Orlando, a Wide World of Sports setup that whatever Major League Soccer is going to end up finding to finish their season, that I would love to be a part of it. But to talk about Major League Soccer, joining the show now is Jeff Reuter of The Athletic, a good friend up north. Jeff, how are you doing? The world's is a little darker today, and lot going on, especially where you are. How are you doing? Are you safe? What has been your reaction to just everything going on up in Minnesota?
Well, how long of a segment do we have? it is. I'm safe. First of all, my wife and I are safe, as is our Greyhound. And this is probably the darkest 100% sunny morning I can remember in Minneapolis. There's not a cloud in the sky. And there's nobody outside. There was just a press conference that was held with the governor, the mayor of both Twin Cities, and various leaders of various law enforcement and National Guard deployments that are currently in the Twin Cities. And they said in St. Paul last night, every person who was arrested for looting, for incendiary behavior, for violence against the police, all of them were from out of town. So what you're seeing now is that the Twin Cities aren't actually, it's not that it's citizens of Minneapolis and St. Paul who are causing the destruction of buildings and of neighborhoods and, all of the kind of trauma gawking that is showing up in the national news. These are people who are coming from out of town. And so now I think we're all processing. You're actually hitting me 15 minutes after we all learned that. So it's we're still kind of processing what that means. What does it mean to have people coming from outside of the state even just to try to make this their, beginning, their kind of their first step, their genesis of what they see to be like their own uprising. It's pretty terrifying stuff, not gonna lie.
Yeah, and I mean, I couldn't look away from the news last night with the protests and the riots happening down in Atlanta, looking basically all across the country at the different types of, public speech and the way that people were expressing their thoughts and feelings towards what was going on, the injustice. But that definitely it's terrifying, and I'm glad that you are safe, and we will obviously continue following along with what's going on and hoping that we get to a point of resolution somehow in some way. But what's the response of some, whether it's Minnesota United players or just other athletes that are located in Minnesota with Minnesota professional teams? What's the response mm-hmm. been like from them?
It has been mostly strong, with a couple of pretty notable silences. I mean, you've seen of the big four sports, if you're looking at, and this is a soccer writer saying that, take that with a grain of salt, but if you're looking at Major League Baseball, NFL, NBA, and NHL, all four Minnesota teams have put out a statement, justice for George Floyd. Back in the protest, there was a really powerful press conference that was mostly led by former NBA veteran Steven Jackson, who was a friend of George Floyd. Carl Anthony Towns was also part of the leadership speaking at that. And I mean, that was a very unmistakable, justice. We need to, remedy the situation. This is a very serious discussion that has been criminally long overdue about racism in the United States. Minnesota United themselves have not put out a statement, which is a bit of a surprise, especially because one of the areas that was most affected by protests over the last couple of nights, the Midway neighborhood, is where Allianz Field is, and they do state to be a very big part of that community. However, players like Ike Opara, former Sporting Kansas City defender, Michael Boxall, Chase Gasper, Noah Billingsley, these players have been, whether it's on social media or actually being at the post-protest cleanup efforts that tend to go on during the day in both cities, they've been very, very active in trying to spread that message of peace and of nonviolence. So,
yeah,
overall pretty strong. But, yeah, I think it's hard because nobody really knows there's no adequate response at this point, because there's no response that's going to bring George Floyd and these others slain black lives back to life, right? And
right.
So, at a certain point, you want to be hesitant of not just posting something to try to get likes or try to go trending or whatever, but it's hard because, if you're silent, you're not trying to combat against that, and you're kind of lackadaisically part of the issue. So I think, again, it's a landscape, whether it's social media, whether it's I think that we're all still learning how to process, how to maneuver, and how to use all of our platforms. And I think that goes for sports media personalities like you and myself. What is our role in all of this too? It's a big discussion that I don't think we're ever going to really find a good best practice for.
That's such a good point you bring up, and I actually had that conversation last night, and we will get into Major League Soccer talk with Jeff, but this is really important, and a conversation I had last night was around the pressure of having a platform during times like this, and when certain things do happen where you feel the pressure to speak out, but you want to be sensitive in that you don't want to say something just to say something. And I talked earlier in the show about the importance of just knowledge is power. Try to gain as much knowledge on the issues happening in our world today and talk with people who don't look like you, people who have different life experiences than you. Try to get every perspective on things that you don't understand, things that are confusing, things that make you uncomfortable, things that make you feel unsettled. And I think a lot of us went to bed last night with that unsettled feeling of just not understanding why these things continue to happen. And then the response, which is equally unsettling, with riots, looting, all of those things. But I, no surprise to hear Ike Opara speaking out. I know he was very vocal in, talking about those issues when he was here with Sporting Kansas City, and a lot of athletes taking to social media, whether that's, releasing a statement or engaging in conversation, but then also getting out in the community as well. So great to see people use their platforms for what they believe and is right and just. And so that is something that I know in Minnesota has been big, just with that being the location of where the murder of George Floyd occurred. But Jeff, I want to dig into some Major League Soccer talk, because your place of work, The Athletic, came under fire for some leaks that were detailed in The Athletic's reporting. Commissioner Don Garber was not very happy. I guess if we're going to go with puns here, Major League Soccer might be an appropriate name for the league.
That would be the headline. Absolutely.
This last week, what can you tell us about what was going on with all of that, and I guess just being as close to it as you are?
Yeah, this is great because I've never actually gotten something like this from an employer, but I'm going to be told to no comment on a lot of parts of this. But what I will say is, just for people who maybe weren't quite aware, what has been happening, and this is reporting that has largely been spearheaded by Sam Shishko, Paul Tenorio, Pablo Maurer, and myself, four staff writers at The Athletic, covering Major League Soccer and American soccer in general. And we've been reporting details, 100% confirmed details. We don't go single source with any of our reporting. We don't just run something because it seems salacious without making sure that both sides have had a chance to comment so that we have the full story with it. And we're putting out details about the Orlando Hub tournament, which they're working towards, which last night the players had an initial vote on. So stay tuned for news about that, I'm sure. Then you had the report that I put out later a week ago from last Thursday, with full details that we obtained through independent sources, which we'll keep fully anonymous, in the documents outline the full testing details for this Orlando tournament, how quarantining will work, how many people will be traveling down, what allotment of staff outside of the players and coaches will be mandatory for teams to travel, will be optional for teams to travel. These kind of crucial details that really, you know, you can talk about this tournament, you can talk about the NBA wanting to go to the Wide World of Sports, you can talk about the NWSL playing in Utah, but until you know these true details of how are they going to pull it off, how are they ensuring players and staff are safe, how are they ensuring that this is going to become a massive flame-up of people from 26 markets across the country suddenly getting a pandemic because they're in such close quarters and they weren't adequately controlled, and now you're bringing it back to all of these markets, and that's a disaster at that point if that happens. So we report on this because we, you know, this is public interest. This isn't just, you know, it's not a trade where you have the reigning defender of the year traded to a team up I-35 for $900,000 of allocation money. And that's the kind of reporting that, of course, we're very used to at this point. We're very used to that. It's entertainment, right? And at the end of the day, sports should be entertainment. It's more powerful than that a lot of times, but it's entertainment. But these sorts of topics about COVID-19, about the pandemic, about testing, about health and safety, and now, honestly, about race relations, I think that's going to become another one of these topics. Those are things, that stories that need to be told. These are reports that need to be put out. And so we fully stand by our reporting. I can't really talk about any other interactions, but it is still very much something that we've noticed, and I think we will continue to feel for quite some time at the publication. And that's okay. That's part of our job.
And you all do a phenomenal job. I think The Athletic has been the leader in all of the MLS return to play news as it concerns, like you just said, the health and safety of players, the financial discussions that are happening between the league and the Players Association. So I want to start there because there's been some back and forth. And based on conversations I've had with different players, past, current, just people throughout the league, there seems to be kind of a, maybe not a general feeling of, I guess, there's not a lot of confidence that for some that this thing will actually come to fruition,
right.
Whereas others feel pretty confident that it will. What's kind of the temperature of the league based on conversations that you've had with the likelihood of the Orlando plan coming to fruition and actually taking place?
Well, there's a couple of different ways to answer that. From the league side, details of this wouldn't have gotten out. It wasn't just reported by The Athletic, but the league has given credence to this, has spoken about it through its clubs and through the league office. So, yes, this is the plan. And I don't think that any part of that would have become public if they were worried that they couldn't pull it off. And when you look at the report that that I put out last Thursday, that report spells out such painstaking details about the testing, about the quarantine, about the travel, about you know, the timelines for each of these things to make sure it's as safe as possible, that the league should feel good about it. And they should look at that plan and say, we've done our research, we've worked with health organizations, we've spoken with our clubs in these markets that are kind of more at risk, specifically Seattle and San Jose. We're working to ensure that we're not setting ourselves up for failure. But then you bring that to the players, and they say, that's great, but my wife is pregnant, and she is slated to give birth in late July, which is the third week of this tournament. I'm going to want to be there for the birth of my child. So these players who are not for Orlando City will then be trying to fly to their markets. And if you leave this, there's no reason to think that you'll be allowed to come back. And so then there's that kind of question of, you know, how obligated are athletes to try to get back on the court for things, very real things like the morale of the country, for getting, I don't know, the club to have some revenue stream to be able to afford them in some cases. You know, and these are things weighing on their minds, but at the end of the day, the health and safety of them and their families will go on far longer than their playing careers. So I think that you're seeing some players grappling with that. If I had to put a percentage on it, which, I mean, this changes daily, Allie, but I think I would say it's still 50-50, because that component of getting a supermajority of players to say, yes, there are risks, and they're undeniable risks, but they're worth doing because of the plan MLS has and because of what this tournament would mean, that is going to be a very significant ask, and I think it's going to take a couple of pushes from MLS to really get that across the line if it's going to happen.
And there's already been some back and forth now, right? It wasn't like, hey, this is our first plan, this is our proposal, and we're good to go, everyone's in agreement, woohoo.
Right.
There's been some back and forth, and there's been some discussions, not just about the health and safety concerns, but on the financial side, what players will be getting paid. So what, you know, just seeing kind of the back and forth that's happened so far, a proposed 20% cut, then 10%, players coming back with their own kind of take on how the financial should work and working out different ways to cut back and put money back in the league and the owners' pockets. How close are we are we on that? And is that, in what your understanding is, the biggest hang-up right now with getting Major League Soccer back?
I think the health and safety part is bigger in terms of what's the tallest hurdle that they're going to need to clear to complete the course. Because if you're looking at the pay component, the players did come back with that 10%. Mm-hmm. And it was it's something that was extended across the duration of the agreed upon but not yet signed collective bargaining agreement, which they landed on in February. So they've already kind of acknowledge that, yes, clubs are going to really want us to take pay cuts. No, we don't want to, but we can do this in a way where it hurts us the least, helps the clubs the most, and in the long run won't kind of hit us at the kneecaps for our next CBA negotiation or for other significant financial portions of their contracts. So that part, I think they've just kind of acknowledged is part and parcel, even though you could make a case that they should be paid more if they're put into a situation like this, but that's a completely different discussion.
Yeah.
But I think that being able to feel like, you know, they're not setting themselves up to catch a pandemic and be away from their families for not just 8 weeks, which is what the tournament would be from the time the training would start to when it would end. If they get this, they would have to be in quarantine in Orlando for far longer. And the idea of tacking on another 2 weeks when they're already gone for eight, you know, that's a lot for these players who are in their 20s and 30s and may have young families. That's a lot to ask them to sacrifice or to potentially put on the line to play this tournament.
Yeah, no, I know that in just conversations I've had, there's a question of, well, why can't we train here and then go? And just it's the length of time being demanded of the players and how hard that is on their family lives. And as we know, everyone has a different family situation. You talk about the young family. Some have partners who work full time. Others have, you know, wives expecting, you know, to either have their first kid or, you know, a second kid. And then they've got two young kids or whatever their situation is. It's
right.
It's different for every player. Not easy by any means, but you bring up, like, it is a young league, and I know that there's been some talk with the NBA of, well, how hard is it when you have such young players to have them following the rules, like when they are in quarantine, if you know, in Orlando,
right,
on these campuses? I know that they've kind of changed the language from saying in a bubble to on a campus, because it just sounds a little less, I guess, scientific.
It sounds more fun.
It
everyone
does.
Loves the term campus. It's not just college, it's Google, it's Facebook, like, it's our campus. It's so
right.
Different, right?
It's a very modern term, I guess, to use, and very on trend. But is there a concern in what, you know, again, in conversations you've had and what your kind of understanding of this proposal is there a big concern with keeping players in quarantine?
Yeah, MLS players are notoriously twitchy in terms of not wanting to just live a 9-to-5, go home, read a book, watch your soaps, go to bed, wake up early, repeat. That's really never been the lifestyle of an American soccer player or a soccer player playing in America. If you look back to the 70s and 80s in the NASL, if you look to the early days of Major League Soccer in the 90s, this is a league that finds ways to skirt the rules and have some fun. And it's great. And it tends to be very harmless. You've seen far fewer moments or incidents where this has become a major issue than you might expect. But, of course, that's a risk. And I think that when you have, if you're just looking at the number of players and club staff who would be making this trip across the 26th, that's almost 1,200 people. And that's not including the people who work for Major League Soccer or the people who work for Disney and ESPN. So that's a lot of people to be putting in one area where they're only interacting with each other. And it's pretty undeniable to think that some of them are eventually going to just want to get out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's another concern. I'm sure that the league is going to put in protocols to say, you know, this is how we're going to ensure, whether it's tracking system or it's, you know, clubs holding a rope like they're in kindergarten or something as they walk down the hallways. I don't know what this looks like, but I'm sure they have something figured out.
That reminds me when I vividly remember in preschool, you had to put your hand on the shoulder of the person in front of you to keep a straight line and make sure no one strayed too far. But I want to talk about the on-the-field stuff and what this will look like in the round-robin tournament-style format that they are proposing when they do get the actual playing back and going. And Paul Tenorio tweeted about this, your coworker, and I thought it was interesting because I think this is a question, and I'm personally in the camp of I think that this tournament style will actually play out really well for Major League Soccer and maybe creating more intrigue. I think it's going to up the competition level. I'm actually intrigued to see how it plays out from that standpoint because I actually think it'll be a good product. But I know that there's been some question about the on-the-field product, and because Major League Soccer is, I guess, perceived to be far behind, and there's some truth to that, than, you know, the professional leagues across the world. I mean, you look at the Bundesliga, it's not, we're not talking about apples to apples here. When you have no fans in attendance, and it amplifies the product on the field more than even just a regular season in a normal game, do you think that's going to be a problem for maybe getting interest from people who aren't diehard soccer fans?
So there's such a difference between watching a game, you know, at Allianz Arena, Bayern Munich Stadium, and it's empty, and it's, you know, it's an echo. You can hear the ball kicked, and it sounds like somebody, you know, threw a stone at a wall or something. But
sounds like tennis.
It does. It really does. And I keep waiting for a grunt with every kick. But I think that you still acknowledge that it's the same sport. It doesn't feel different. You have the same sight lines that you have from watching TV broadcast that you would have if fans were there. So it's a little bit easier to accept that, okay, this is pretty close to the normal thing. But if you're playing at the Wide World Sports Complex in Orlando, it looks like a youth tournament. There aren't bleachers there. They would have, I think, 20 cameras is what I'm hearing, or so per field. So you have a lot of angles that you can work with, which is really cool just in terms of being able to make this production something that's unique. But without fans, it's hard because arguably, that's the single biggest draw to casual sports fans for Major League Soccer, is the fan culture, is people wanting to relive kind of the college sports, standing for the entirety of the game, organized chanting, have two more beers than you remember having, that sort of thing. That lifestyle is very unique to Major League Soccer. And I'm not just talking about Cascadia. I'm talking about the Blue Culture, and I'm talking about the Wonder Wall in Minnesota. Like, these are the lifeblood of what makes these clubs so interesting. And that's why you're seeing, like, the Timbers Army put out statements saying, we want organic support. We aren't going to just send TIFO for the sake of a TV camera if we can't be there supporting. And then, every fan is going to want to be a fan in the way that they think is best. But it would be very different. Piping in crowd noise when there are no bleachers alongside a field, frankly, that's pretty comical to me, the idea that you would be trying to do that or trying to replicate that in the place where there would never be any fans.
Yeah.
But I think at this point, in 2020, people just want something that resembles what life was like before the pandemic. And if they can watch soccer, I think that they will put up with Alexi Lalas standing in a studio for 30 minutes, recording 20 versions of him cheering in the crowd and then mashing that all together so you just have like this chorus of Alexi Lalas cheering for 90 minutes throughout every game. It would be really weird. It would be very MLS. But I think people would embrace it if it means that they can watch their team play.
Yeah. And again, it's I think the struggle is that you are going to have a group of people who are going to watch no matter what. If there's crowd noise, great. If there's not, who cares? I love Major League Soccer. I want to watch. But there's a huge opportunity, and we've talked about this a lot here in Kansas City, for Major League Soccer, and even talking to manager Peter Vermees about this, in that there's a chance for Major League Soccer to kind of use this opportunity to maybe pick up some new fans and gain some momentum for the league in the U.S. that they've kind of struggled with. And again, it's a relatively new league. They're only 25 years old, started in 1996, so they've still got a ways to go, and other leagues have quite the leg up on them, but there is still an opportunity nonetheless. But it's just going to be interesting to see how they do navigate from a visual standpoint, the optics of airing these games and making it a good viewing experience for current and potentially new fans as well. But another thing, Jeff, and we're talking with Jeff Reuter of The Athletic, does great work there covering all things Major League Soccer, Minnesota United, so go check out his work there. If you don't already subscribing just to read the great coverage they do is worth every single penny. But when the league was postponed, the teams in the Western Conference occupying spots 1 and 2 were Sporting Kansas City and Minnesota United.
That's right.
What do you see? I thought it was interesting this past week. Kyrie Shelton said that he feels like he's in the best shape of his life. And I was like, we've had totally different quarantines, buddy, if that's how you feel, because I am even close. And not that it's my job. I'm not a professional athlete. I don't need to keep my body in tip-top shape at all times of the year.
But at-home workouts, it's not for everyone. And if he found an Instagram influencer who could get him into the best shape of his life, he's got a career that will extend long past his playing days, I'll tell you that.
Oh my gosh. I was like, when he said that, my head kind of like fell out of my ears, or my brain flew out of my ears, because I was like, have you been quarantining? Do you know that there's a pandemic going on? No one's having the same reaction. But all of that being said, and we look at this with the Bundesliga as well. You can't really look at the form that teams were in when this whole thing originally started and the league was postponed,
right?
Because there's been so much time in between. That being said, what teams, in your opinion, are the most advantaged going into this potential restart here in the next month or two?
Yeah, it's really interesting, because you're looking at Major League Soccer was only 2 weeks into its season, and the Bundesliga was about 26 or 28. So you're also catching players who are just coming back from preseason form. And in general, people kind of look the other way. Like, writers will look the other way in terms of saying, like, playing an excellent game. Like, we'll throw that word out a little easier in March than we maybe would in September, mm-hmm. because all of these players are coming back from their offseason, and MLS has one of, if not the longest offseason in world soccer. So you're catching players who already were kind of fighting to get back. So I could see also where a player would say, you know, I only had to play 2 games, so I got a little bit of a tune-up. I'm not carrying an injury. You know, I haven't had to cut during games. I haven't had to get the same sort of wear and tear on my knees, my leg muscles, my upper body, my back, all that stuff. So I can definitely see where they would feel that way. That makes a little bit of sense to me, but I still would love to know how they're able to maintain that. But I think that teams that didn't have injuries in general are going to be in the best spot. The hard part about MLS is that you only have 28 to 30 players on your roster. That's your hard maximum. And there are very few teams that are able to truly feel like they have depth because of how the salary cap is structured, because of things like allocation money and all of these other mechanisms that we'd love to make fun of. But a team like Atlanta is still going to be in a very difficult spot, because they didn't have the rest of the transfer window to figure out how to replace Joseph Martinez, one of the best goal scorers in Major League Soccer history already after just 3 seasons, who tore his ACL in the first weekend of the season. Mm-hmm. They have 2 players who are playing in the USL, the second division of United States Soccer, as their only strikers on the roster right now. They're not going to be able to replicate what Joseph Martinez was doing. And in fact, they've now lost time to be training with the team, to get used to the tactics, to get used to what adjustments are they going to make with a much more kind of physical, stereotypical, just American, head the ball in, Brian McBride style striker like Adam John, or a young player like J.J. Williams, who doesn't have MLS experience. Those guys don't have the reps of playing under Franck DeBoer, the head coach, or playing with their teammates to get a sense of, how does Petey Martinez want me to run? Where is Ezequiel Barco going to cut in, and where do I need to be to give him that space? So in a weird way, Atlanta might be the most disadvantaged team in this entire thing. But they're probably already going to be at a disadvantage in 2020 anyway. I think Minnesota and Kansas City are both fairly healthy right now. So the Midwest should be pretty well represented once this kicks off. It's going to be very interesting to see if this comes off, just how these players are able to kind of, you know, are they going to be able to hit the ground running, or are they going to have some growing pains? And if they have some growing pains in these first games, I don't care how great of a spotlight this tournament's going to be, Allie, that's going to be a really tough selling point for Major League Soccer, for the people who already have a notion of it being a retirement league, a bad league, all of these things. If that's their first re-exposure to it, you might not ever get them back.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think across the board, a lot of people are understanding of the times we're in, but when it comes to sports, and when everything's picking back up, and if there's any competition with something else on TV to watch, like you said, it could be hard to keep those fans if the initial experience or experiences are not good. Jeff, before I let you go, what are you looking forward to seeing with Major League Soccer returning? What is, like, one thing, whether it is in the off-the-field handlings or on the field, what is something that is kind of really you find yourself coming back to and thinking about?
It's crazy, but in a way, it's VAR.
Oh my gosh. I never hear like those three letters again, I think be okay.
But think about it. How many thousands of people across the country were infuriated by VAR? And anytime you would see Chris Penzo, the center official, put his finger up to his ear and just kind of hold play with his other hand and all that stuff, and everyone's starting to boo and whatever, and we're all really getting into this, and we can't see the replay in the crowd. And the journalists in the press box, they're like suddenly hovering over their laptops trying to load their YouTube TV to try to find the stream, all this stuff. And it's just such an intense 2 minutes of something that really doesn't matter, right? But getting so invested into something like that is not how we're functioning right now as a society. Mm-hmm. And it's just that simple joy of being so angry at this process that is so imperfect and is frankly just poorly done most of the time. Being able to go back to that kind of lifestyle is something that I truly do miss, that is very, very, very uniquely Major League Soccer.
I want to like yell at my TV. I do. I miss it.
Yeah.
I miss getting riled up about sports. And I'll be honest, I didn't watch or follow the Bundesliga super closely before they just came back. Like, you know the young American players, you keep tabs on them,
right,
and what's going on, their development. But my team is Mönchengladbach, and I've had a great time watching them. Do you have a team in the Bundesliga?
I think it's Schalke, which is a bummer right now.
Ooh.
But, you know, they've had a really good history of having American players. This has gone back for over a decade, too. So I've just kind of kept closer tabs on them. And they hired David Bodner, who played for the U.S. men's national team in the 90s, as their head coach. So, not great right now. But brighter days ahead, maybe. I don't know. Or not. We'll find out.
Great talking with you. And just again, if you don't already subscribe to The Athletic and you're looking for a reason, the work that Jeff and all of the MLS writers for The Athletic do is worth every single penny. So, Jeff, thank you again for the time. Stay safe up there. We look forward to talking to you again soon when hopefully Major League Soccer has a bit more of a concrete plan in place and we have some real dates to work with. But have a good rest of your weekend. And again, we will talk to you real soon.
Sounds good, Allie.
All right. See ya. All right, there is Jeff Reuter of The Athletic. We are going to take a break here on Sports Saturday, and we will be back after this. Welcome back to Sports Saturday on Sports Radio 810 WHB. I'm Allie Trost. Blake Schneider is running the board. And great stuff on that last segment from Jeff Reuter of The Athletic, talking all things Major League Soccer, the return to play, and all the details surrounding that. So if you missed that, catch it on the podcast page after the show, and you can hear that entire conversation. But as things usually do happen, right when we get off the phone with Jeff, The Athletic has just reported that the Major League Soccer Players Association last night approved a return to play plan, say that one 10 times fast, for games in Orlando. That proposal has been sent back to Major League Soccer to be accepted or countered. Details of the plan will be coming out soon on The Athletic Soccer in a couple of minutes. So stay tuned for that. There's been, I lost track of how many proposals, counter proposals have happened with Major League Soccer. It's been more than just.
I think it was 127,000.
It's 11 million. Yeah. More than one, more than two. So they've been going back and forth now, trying to reach an agreement there. But as Jeff kind of outlined in our conversation, there's still a lot of concern. There's health concerns. Players come from all sorts of family situations and are in different parts of life that would make being away for 2 months far from easy. And then on top of that, you factor in all of the exposure that they are potentially, putting their families at risk with playing and traveling back and forth if they are trying to get back for the birth of a child and how that will work. So there's a lot of questions yet to be answered, but hopefully we will learn in a few minutes here from The Athletic what Major League Soccer is planning on doing. But Blake, we talked about this. The Chiefs, we have a bajillion sound bites. I mean, so much sound from the Chiefs this last week, but I kind of went through it, pulled out some things that I thought were interesting. Again, you can actually find all of the sound, all of the press conferences on YouTube, on the 810 YouTube page, 810 WHB. We talked with the assistants. We talked with some of the players, Clyde Edwards-Helaire, Mitchell Schwartz, and Harrison Butker. But I want to start and play a clip from Mitchell Schwartz talking about the likelihood of the NFL season and that taking place. and then he was also asked by Soren Petro about, the NFL Players Association, how closely associated he is with that and kind of what his experience with those conversations have been like, what his understanding is. Here's that.
None that I've been a part of, I'm sure, at the high level, they're doing all that with, Treader and D and all the team reps. We have had the benefit of time. I mean, we're still 2 months away from, when training camp would start. So we've been particularly fortunate as a league to kind of get hit with this at the right time. And also, obviously, selfishly, a month earlier and no Super Bowl. So, it's kind of just worked out timing perspective all the way around. It seemed realistic what he said. I mean, he's not trying to be a total optimist. It wasn't doom and gloom. My inclination from the get-go was that they're going to find a way to make it happen. There's so much money involved from all sides. And, that was something that when they were talking about, I guess free agency was the first thing, post-COVID. And there were some people saying, oh, they shouldn't do it. And, the optics and all that. And of course it was a massive success because people love the NFL. They want the content. That's one of the most fun, particular days of the year where teams are getting influxes of new talent. The draft went through and the ratings were up, 30-35% across the board. And so those kind of two events kind of strengthened my view that there's just a lot at stake, mostly money, and that's just the reality of it. But from all sides, I mean, we obviously want to play. This is what we do. It's fun for us. We miss playing. We miss hanging out with our buddies. We miss the competition. It's just beneficial from all sides to come together and find a solution. And I just thought, with how much was on the line and at stake, they would definitely come out with a solution. And, I'm sure it's very difficult. Like I said, I've not been privy to any conversations. I can't imagine having to figure all that out, medically, football, fans, revenues. It's so many moving parts. Luckily that's not part of my, job capacity. I'd probably have less hair if that was so. It's going pretty good. I finally got my post-COVID haircut, and sad state of affairs.
So there's Mitchell Schwartz talking about what might happen with the NFL this season. And like he said, there's still just a lot of questions. And the one thing the NFL has that other leagues don't is some time. But as I mentioned earlier, time is a move-in. It's moving quickly. And there's a lot to be figured out before fall comes, which will be sooner than later. Funny comment about losing more hair, having to make those decisions. I think we would all be balding if we had to figure out some of the things that the NFL is going to have a plan for ahead of the season. And again, there is a lot of financial concern with revenue and losing the revenue streams of, if they can't have fans in attendance and just all of the things. But the one thing Mitchell Schwartz said that I think everyone can be in agreement with is that the NFL will find a way. There's too much on the line. They found a way to execute a draft pretty seamlessly, I think, with very few very few hiccups. At least I was expecting a lot more, and I think a lot of other people were too. But there's a lot to be figured out, and it was nice to hear the always realistic Mitchell Schwartz just kind of laying it all out for you. Blake, what do you think about the NFL season and what this is going to look like?
I think it's definitely going to happen. I think they're pretty much taking all the precautions necessary, kind of testing and seeing what every other league is doing right now. I mean, NFL has the most time right now to think about anything, and I think that they've been at the forefront since this whole shutdown started. I mean, they were one of the ones that were like, hey, we're still going to go ahead. I mean, you saw how they did the draft. I mean, they were on it. I was actually pretty surprised at how smooth the draft went when you got 60-year-old dudes working with Zoom and internet. I mean, most of those, I'll promise you, I know firsthand that coaches are not the most tech savvy. They're not. They can X's and O.
And the funniest part,
they can't Zoom and go.
The best part too with these Zooms, that's kind of a hard couple of words to say back. The Zooms is like, okay, the lack of understanding that, hey, you got to flip your camera, right? I feel bad for these like TV stations that actually rely on the video. I mean, we post video to our YouTube page, but like the quality isn't the most important thing. It's like the information. Whereas if it's like on TV, you have a certain, like, it's easier to build out a package for a show if it's in a certain format. And that includes the camera being horizontal on these players and coaches. And you would be, I just kind of laugh at how many are just, you know, they're just hopping on the Zoom. They're just talking to the media. When you're up at a press conference and you are in a normal setting with the podium, you don't have to worry about the camera angle. The camera people get that all set up for you. You just go up there and talk. So that's kind of been.
Well, and so, I mean, just to bring it back, I know that they've been, you know, we saw with the draft, we've seen with just kind of how they've really been, you know, throwing out all these different ideas and really getting together and things. So I think football is a safe bet that I really feel like it's going to happen. As far as college goes, don't know. Couldn't tell you. That's a whole nother beast. But I think that it's going to look different, of course. There's going to be some differences. I mean, we have no idea what they're going to do with the fans. We've heard them talking about, you know, maybe filling a third of capacity and figuring out spacing that they can do and maybe not having as much vending in all the vendors there. But I'm very confident, and I think a lot of the players are very confident. I think a lot of the players are ready because this is kind of a weird thing with football is – it's not like basketball. It's not like baseball. I mean, there's very rare instances in baseball, but football, you can, hopefully nobody ever does, obviously, but like you can die playing football. So when you're already kind of throwing your life on the line like that, I know I've made this dramatic all of a sudden.
I was like, whoa.
Okay. Well, but you can. You can paralyze yourself. There's so many things that you can go wrong in football. So I think the mentality that some of these guys has is, you know what, let me go ahead and sign my name on this dotted line. I'm cool with doing this because we already play a very dangerous sport.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's weighing risk versus reward. And right now I think a lot of the players are comfortable and ready to get back out there.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. And I also think, too, like with the NFL, there are fewer teams than like a college football or just it's easier to have control over the quarantine protocols that you have in place, the travel, getting people to and from games safely, however they end up going about that, whether it is doing something like the NBA and Major League Soccer are looking to do, which is quarantining every team in one location on a campus, not in a bubble. But something I thought was interesting that I read was that the NFLPA medical director, Tom Mayer, says that they're working with Oakley on developing protective face masks for players ahead of 2020. With, like, you know, in place of the face mask that they already have to maybe block some of the germs that would be transmitted when you are lining up face to face next to a guy or, you know, just the contact that happens naturally throughout a game. And that's not something that like other leagues and other sports can say that they have, I think, as much would have an easy time working to create something like that because of just the equipment that a football player has and like the gear that they wear allows them to maybe get creative in that way.
Yeah. I mean, when I heard this originally, I was like, dude, there's no way. And most players aren't going to go for that. I would have to see the prototype that they come out with. I mean, I would like to see what it looks like. But, you know, you're not going to go out there and play a basketball game with a mask on your face.
Right.
You're just not. It's not – one, it's not going to be healthy for you to keep – when you're breathing at that high of a rate, to keep breathing in carbon dioxide that you've just, you know, breathed out, it's yeah. not healthy for you. So you're going to see issues with that. So I'd be very surprised if a lot of the players wanted to add something on to – something that already obstructs your view. I mean, I don't know if you've ever worn a football helmet, Allie, just even for fun.
I've put one on, and yeah, I can't imagine heavy, playing a sport with one of those.
And it obstructs your view, and, I mean, then you got to play with a mouthpiece. Half the guys don't. But, mm-hmm. I mean, so there's a lot of things that already kind of, you know, weigh on you when you breathe. So I'd really be surprised to see what kind of something that they could add to the mask already.
Yeah.
So, but I when I first heard that, I was like, I don't see the players really being on board for that.
But at the same time, though, like, I leave that to the people way smarter than
for
me
sure.
and the people who, like, have the ability to possibly figure something out. I mean,
yeah.
that could completely change the game. I just and I think that this is the risk that not just the NFL, but every league runs, is that when you are so close to your teammates at all times. I mean, last season, do you remember how many players were put on, like, the, you know, either did not practice or were, you know, not able to play in games because of, like, an illness running around the locker
oh, yeah.
room. That wasn't just a, you know, 2 weeks of the season. That happened throughout the entire course of the season. They had players out with illness. I think Frank Clark's was a little bit of an outlier in that he had some other issues going on. But even still, like, it's so easy when you were in such close quarters to contract something, whether it's the flu, whether it's COVID-19, whether it's, I mean, strep throat, like, whatever it is. You know, when you are closely associated with those people and you're competing against them, you're just constantly transmitting things back and forth. It's so easy to get something. So if they are able to figure out some sort of mask or attachment that allows the players to breathe easily and not, like, put themselves at risk of, like, passing out or doing anything that would also hurt them in, you know, a negative way, I'm interested to see what they're able to come up
with. Definitely interested. Yeah, I want to see the prototype, and then I might change my mind.
We'll see. We'll see. But the other piece of sound I want to get to is about the running back room. And Dylan McCullough, the running backs coach, talked about the running back competition. This time last year, Eric Bieniemy, the offensive coordinator, had named Damian Williams as a starter. We have not heard anything as far as who a definite starter is. I think there's a lot of assumption that it will be Clyde Edwards-Helaire. Maybe it'll be Damian Williams. Maybe there is more competition there than we do think. But Dylan McCullough answers questions about that.
Well, I guess, just like I said earlier, you want to get all these guys out there, you want to get going and see what we got. One thing we know is on, you know, just looking at some guys' pass and the snapshots we got of guys, whether it be DeAndre at Washington, obviously with Durrell and Damian and Darwin with us, and then you look at, you know, where we drafted Clyde and what his body of work was in college, you know, we got some high-end players in our room, you know. And I know what the guys that are returning, some guys that we feel comfortable with, but again, you always want to continue to enhance the room and create competition and just raise the level of the room. And I think that's what we have. How it all shakes down ultimately, we're gonna let that thing play out on the football field. That's the beauty of our game. You know, we get a chance to go out and let's see what's what. So, and the whole room knows that, man, and these guys looking forward to it. Get along well, you know, very competitive, however, very supportive also. And they know at the end of the day what they do is going to speak to where their role is when the season gets started. So I'm looking forward to that.
So there's Dylan McCullough talking about the competition in the running back room. And Blake, you pointed out Darryl, Darwin, DeAndre, Damian.
Throw some D's on it.
Your name has to start with a D unless you're Clyde Edwards-Helaire. And maybe maybe that's why he'll be the starter. C comes before D in the alphabet.
Ooh,
you know?
True,
don't
true.
You know?
Don't you know?
Don't
there.
You know? But no, it's going to be interesting for sure. And I mean, if I had to just look at this room right now, and again, this is solely based on what we saw last year from the players returning, what our understanding of the new additions is with DeAndre and with Clyde Edwards-Helaire, I kind of feel like Darwin Thompson might be the odd man out. I don't think he didn't get nearly as many reps as I kind of thought he would last season, especially
yeah.
given the injuries that occurred, how out of favor LeSean McCoy was for such a long stretch at the end of the season. And I never really got the sense that they felt like they were sure in what they had in him. And now when you up the competition, I think it just pushes him farther down the totem pole.
Yeah, I mean, you have your starter in Damien, of course. You draft a first-round running back in Clyde Edwards-Helaire. I have always been a big Darrell Williams fan. He doesn't get talked about enough, but anytime he was in, he was a strong runner. He had good hands out of the backfield, and I think he was just a guy that was able to pick up the slack when both Damien and LaShawn really were either out, injured, or just, you know, weren't playing. So you're not going to have four and five running backs on the roster. That's just not how the Chiefs operate. We usually carry about three tight ends. You know, we carry some DBs. So it's just, unfortunately, because I was on the Darwin Thompson train, especially since last season, but we didn't see enough from him last year. And I was very surprised. I don't know if that's just a situational thing. I don't know if that's a playbook issue. I don't know if that's just a trust factor within the coaching, within the coaching staff. So, unfortunately, yeah, it kind of looks like he is his proving ground is going to be in preseason, and if he just doesn't make a big enough splash, and even if he does, he still might be the odd man out.
Yeah, and then even especially, I think something else that kind of solidifies that is just hearing the anticipated role that Dave Tobe and the special teams, Andy Hill, Dave Tobe, the role that they see him having, and I'm talking about Clyde Edwards-Helaire on special teams as well, in addition to his role on the field as a running back that can also catch. I mean, I think that it'll be interesting, especially with this, you know, different looking off season, how prepared some of these rookies will be. I think it'll go one of two ways, right? It'll be the teams that, you know, do a good job in the classroom, the teaching of the fundamentals, the playbook, the teams that are good at getting that across to their young guys, their rookies, their new additions, they'll be fine, I think, in that area. The teams that maybe struggle a bit more in that and rely more on that on the field, in the facilities kind of time together, might struggle a bit more. I look at, you know, the teams going through a head coaching change. Look at the Dallas Cowboys, for example. I mean, God, can you imagine a worse time to be going through contract negotiations that have your franchise quarterback out of meetings, not, you know, participating, and then you have a new head coach on top of all that? The Chiefs are in a great spot. They are bringing back such a large core of their talent from last season that got them to the Super Bowl. They have a head coach in Andy Reid who isn't just experienced in the NFL, but has been with the Chiefs for, gosh, how many years now? I mean, since 2013. So that's a best case scenario, and they have a year under their belt with new defensive coordinator Steve Spagnuolo. I think that they are in a great spot, but still a lot of questions with every league, every sport, every team. No one is immune to that. But Blake, it's been fun.
It's been a good day, Allie. It's been finally
back. We are back. Thank you for tuning in. You can catch the show if you missed it, or if you want to tune in halfway through, find it on the podcast page under additional programming on 810WHB.com. And we will see you right back here next week on Sports Saturday, 9 to 11 a.m. on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Have a great weekend, everybody. Making mama so